Well, the mock trade deadline was right. Avery Bradley and Tobias Harris got traded for an all-star power forward out of the 2007 high school class, as we predicted. So, where were you when you heard the news?
I was taking a nap. I thought that if this trade happened, I mean, we had the earlier Woj tweet of how there were discussions. I'm like, oh, well, you know, if there are discussions, it's still going to take a while. And I knew it was going to be a busy night with watching games and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, okay, I have some time to rest. And then I wake up to the buzz of my phone saying from one of my friends who isn't in basketball media being like, what's up with this Blake Griffin trade? And I was like, oh, I don't think anything happened. And then I just flipped up my phone and then I saw what happened.
Yeah, I missed it initially because we were putting together a cat tree for the cats. But what are the terms here so we have it before we blather on any further?
Okay, so the terms of the trade are Blake Griffin, Willie Reed, and Bryce Johnson going from the Clippers to the Pistons in exchange for Tobias Harris, Avery Bradley, Boban Marjanovic, Detroit's 2018 first-round pick, which is very lightly protected and going to convey this year, and a 2019 second, which could be Detroit's. We don't know the exact term. They also own another pick as well, so it could be either of those, really. But again, it's a second-round pick. And this is a massive trade for the direction of both franchises. There are a lot of angles that we need to go through with this, but I think the choices that were made here are there. And I'll let you talk first, because I've already framed it before this trade was announced with kind of what I want to talk about with it, but I'll let you go first because I know where I want to go.
Well, I'll react to that because I think it's a study in the contrasts of these front offices. And recall, of course, that the Clippers, until not too long ago, were helmed by Rock Divers. Now they've got Lawrence Frank, but also some veteran front office personnel in there, not the least of whom is Jerry West, Michael Winger from OKC, Mark Hughes. So totally revamped Clippers front office. And the Pistons, of course, are still helmed by Van Stan Gundy, and this seemed very much like a save your job kind of trade for Detroit. Get a big name in there, and now, you know, you at least get yourself another year and a half to kind of see, oh, we got this guy in there, see how it works. But it is very, very likely that Van Gundy will not be in Detroit when the financial Pied Piper comes calling. And I don't know why I said Pied Piper, that doesn't mean anything, but when the financial burden really comes, which is $37 million for Blake Griffin in 2020-21 and $39 million for him in 2021-22, and when he will be well into his early 30s.
I think there's a chance he's going to pick up that player option. That's my go at it. But yeah, I think so. For me, the story of this trade is the most dangerous thing in the NBA is someone who is GMing for their job. Ideally, also in terms of the negative, somebody who misevaluates talent. And so Blake Griffin, when he signed that contract, which was 7 months ago, just about. You and I talked about how, while there was a justification for the Clippers in terms of their arena, in terms of everything that's going on with that franchise, they thought they couldn't rebuild, Steve Ballmer wants a winner, that it was an albatross for them, that Blake Griffin getting paid that kind of money for a five-year commitment was a huge mistake. And 7 months later, without any particularly strong evidence to discredit the analysis that we provided, Stan Van Gundy not only traded for that contract, I'm going to use Van Gansundy, but it doesn't really matter. is that he not only traded for that contract, but treated it as a positive asset. Because when you look at what Detroit gave up in this deal, they treated it like, oh man, this is a good player on a good contract. And that is not the way that I see Blake Griffin on this contract.
No, I mean, and after this summer, he has already had another knee injury as well that's caused him to miss time, among many other injuries as well. And he really has put up the counting stats this year, but the true shooting percentage is down, taking more jumpers than ever. And we'll get into obviously the fit for both of these teams on the floor to be sure as well. But yeah, that Griffin contract is going to really hamstring this team going forward. I mean, and we saw that as a negative asset, and they're able to get back obviously that first round pick, which I still actually do not expect the Pistons to make the playoffs. I think they probably maybe they got a little bit better for this year with this deal, but not a ton. I would say they still got big problems in the backcourt and on the wing now, and they're really going to miss Harris. And it's not like they, you know, at power forward there's a huge upgrade, or I'm sorry, that there is a huge hole compared to the way there is on the wing in Detroit. So you know, they're probably giving up maybe the 13th, 12th pick in the draft, something like that. Maybe if they make the playoffs, it gets to be 16 or 17. And then they're also giving up Tobias Harris, who is a starter on a good contract, having a very nice season. And Avery Bradley, probably his, I mean, we talked about on the 15 and 60 yesterday, is at least in my opinion, maybe the most overrated player in the NBA, but still a quality starter and a guy who teams might have been willing to give up assets for to try to continue to compete this season. And we'll see if in fact the Clippers try to move him again here. Hilariously, he can actually be traded back to Boston now if they wanted to do that. But nonetheless, that they took what we think is a bad contract and they got a first rounder and Tobias Harris, a starter on a good contract, and Avery Bradley, who also has some value. They did have to take on Boban, which was kind of bad money. So that's a little part of this as well. That's positive value flowing back in Detroit's favor. And then they're also getting that second rounder too. So it does seem like very clearly, if you just look at what's going each direction in this trade, it's to the Clippers' benefit.
And I think it's even stronger than that. I mean, I don't like doing grades. People know that because it's something easy you can point to. But to me, this is in line with an AF time trade. So an A for the Clippers, an F for the Pistons, because of how hamstrung the Pistons are now. You talked about how they got out of Boban's contract in this. They did not get out of John Lure's contract in this. So if you think about the money that they have tied up for the next three seasons in terms of big men who can't really play any other position, those three guys combined to make $67 million in 2018-19, so not even this year. And then I think it's over $70 million in 2019-20. So this is your team. They're not going to have cap space. There's no real way for do that. They don't have their own first-round pick this year. So they're basically married to the mid-level exception and things like that to improve this team. They have one of the weaker wing rotations in the entire league now. I use the term swingman for twos and threes, but you can go in whatever direction.
Yeah.
But so those two positions, they have one of the weakest rotations in the league now. And so they don't really have ways to get better. And Griffin and Drummond are both talented guys. I think that while Griffin is shooting more threes now than he was before, it's not like, oh my God, that solves all their spacing problems or anything like that. Tolliver, I saw as a more aggressive shooter and somebody you had to defend differently than Griffin. I do like that Blake is going to be able to have the ball in his hands a little bit more, but outside of that, there are a lot of problems here. And remember, also, I talked about their weak wing rotation. One of those guys is Stanley Johnson, who we just spent a few minutes yesterday talking about how he can't shoot, and so he becomes a different kind of player on this deal after this deal as well. So I don't think the Pistons make sense. They're completely locked in to what they're doing, and there's no real way out of it other than theoretically, like trading Blake Griffin or DeAndre Drummond, which brings its own challenges because other teams are gonna wisen up to Blake Griffin's contract. They probably already have. And then Drummond is a whole complicated other thing. And, you know, I think he'll be a better value on his contract than Blake, but I don't think his game is going to age particularly well either.
All right. We got to talk a lot more about the financial implications here as well. Take you through where everybody is in terms of the tax and talk about the fit for these teams on the floor. We haven't gotten to what's going on with the Clippers yet. So much to break down in this trade. But first, this for MeUndies. You'd like to look good for your significant other this Valentine's Day, I would assume. And if so, you could check out MeUndies matching pairs, which is a fun gift for you and your Valentine. They are made from the softest materials on earth, 3 times softer than cotton. I own many pairs of MeUndies. Some of them were sent to me by the company, and I bought some other ones because as soon as I tried them, I realized that they were much more comfortable than any other pairs that I own. They're kind of underwear. They never bunch up. You forget that you have them on. They really are just fabulously comfortable. They have a lot of cool patterns, kind of wild patterns, more basic stuff as well. And once again, Valentine's Day is a great time to get started with them. If you're a first-time purchaser, get 20% off plus free shipping when you purchase MeUndies matching pairs. They guarantee that both you and your significant other will love your matching pairs or your money back. 20% off matching undies for you and your significant other and that 100% satisfaction guarantee. Order by February 5th for free standard shipping at MeUndies.com/capspace. That /capspace URL is, remember, we'll be talking about that plenty with regard to the Pistons and Clippers very shortly. MeUndies.com/capspace is that URL. Go to MeUndies.com/capspace and let them know that you came from us. So let's talk a little bit more about Detroit's financial situation since we started getting into it now. We released our projections on Patreon. If you're a Patreon subscriber, we've already got those out here less than an hour and a half after the trade went down. We're going to continue to do that through the trade deadline. deadline. And of course, we do that for all the big signings in the offseason as well. So adding Blake Griffin's $29.5 million for this year, he had a 15% trade bonus. He actually quietly signed for slightly less than the max, about $200K less. So the way it's going to work for his trade bonus, he can't get all 15% because you can only go up to what your individual max would be. So he gets about $200K this year and then $200K added to his salary for the remaining 3 years of the contract before that player option that he might potentially pick up for $39 million in 2021-22. So that means, but he gets paid by the Clippers about $860K as of this moment. But right now then, adding Griffin, adding Reed and Bryce Johnson, who has his third year option declined, both of those guys are free agents at the end of this year. They are $2.2 million below the tax. So they still have some operating room if they want to make some more moves or get someone on the buyout market. They have not very much left of their full mid-level, although they could use the BAE as well,
but they should probably save it for next year.
Probably, yes. But and then next year they are already committed, assuming they bring back Reggie Bullock, who is $2.5 million non-guaranteed, but he's actually been starting for them, so they'll probably want to bring him back. And then they got Eric Moreland, who is also going to play. He's right at the minimum, $1.8 million for next year. So he or with all those guys in, they've got $7 million or so below the tax line for next year, and you imagine they would not be going into the tax given unless the team just really starts performing quite a bit. And so they wouldn't be able to use their full mid-level next year. Might be able to bring in a few guys, see if they can purge some more salary potential. And they also would have to, or wouldn't have to, but they probably would want to re-sign Anthony Tolliver. And actually, I think they might have used the BAE on Tolliver this year, come to think of it. He's making $3.2 million, so I think they must have. $3.29 million.
You are correct. They used it on Anthony Tolliver, so they don't have it for next year or this year. Yay!
Yeah, so never mind on that. But so they're basically limited to close to the minimum now. They've got a little bit left of their full MLE. They used $6.7 million of that $8.4 on Langston Galloway this year. So,
well, I think they actually used all of the rest on Eric Moreland because they gave him more than the minimum.
Yeah. All right. So, well, that's the danger of doing these immediately yeah. after the trade. But so next year, though, they'll probably be limited to not spending their full MLE next year. So to add to this team, and now what do they have on this team, right? I mean, they've got Reggie Jackson still out probably for another month or so. They've got Ish Smith at the point. Langston Galloway has been in and out of the rotation. Luke Kennard is starting for them right now at the two, I guess, with Bradley out. They've got Bullock to play the three, but not really any elite defensive options there. And so they're going to rely a ton on Blake Griffin's playmaking. But Blake's post-ups, there's going to be no room there with Drummond, who is just as limited of a threat outside of a few feet as DeAndre Jordan is, and doesn't have the advantage of years and years of experience playing with Blake to avoid gumming up the spacing. And then you also mentioned Stanley Johnson, who's their best defensive option on the wing, but as we talked about yesterday, is not really elite there, and then he's really struggled to shoot as well. So I don't see this team getting a ton better, and really the one, they do add someone who probably has more one-on-one skill than they had in the past, which is Griffin, but that one-on-one skill is bludgeoning smaller players in the post, and he's not going to really have the room to do that with Andre Drummond around.
He also won't have as much spacing in terms of his passing ability, just because they don't really have a ton of that even on the roster. I don't particularly trust Reggie shooting. Kennard can, yeah, there's some elements of that he can bring, but they're going to need a lot more talent there, and as I said, they have limited means to do so. So yeah, I think personally, I think this trade is more likely than not an absolute disaster for the Pistons. It will certainly win them some attention, just like certain moves that other teams did where they signed veterans and everyone's like, oh, look at they're really making moves over the summer, and then it didn't really work out. That's really what this is a headline move rather than something that really helps them, unless Blake Griffin really defies expectations, and that could happen. He's talented enough to do so, but he's not put in the circumstances that are particularly favorable to make that happen.
The one way that I think, just to play devil's advocate, that maybe this works out is just maybe Griffin is just so good of a passer, and Drummond has improved as a passer as well, that maybe they can make the spacing work just because they have that much passing in the front court now. And that with the shooting around those guys, maybe they can really bludgeon guys on the boards as well. They do have pretty good mobility among Griffin and Drummond in the front court for being a traditional front court. Maybe Blake continues to refine his three-point shot to some degree, although there's nobody to really set him up either. But they do have more passing than they've had, and Griffin, even though he's not what he used to be, provides more one-on-one scoring as well. So maybe this works out to some degree, and maybe with Kennard and with Reggie Bullock, who shot it very well on three-pointers this year, Ish Smith and BG is just an awful fit, unfortunately. You know, that's not too good. I don't know how good of a fit Reggie Jackson is with Griffin either.
Well, and how do you feel about this defensively? So, yeah. That's another concern that I have. I mean, it's certainly not awful, but I mean, you're sitting there going, okay, well, you're going to need your other players to do some heavy lifting, because Drummond, I think his defensive capability is higher than his actual impact so far, and they don't have much defense on the perimeter right now, or at least defenders that can play offense.
I think they're a little bit better defensively. They'll be much better on the boards now.
Yes, that's true.
Griffin and Drummond. Harris was an inadequate defensive rebounder. They didn't really get any rebounding at all from their front court outside of Drummond. They were a surprisingly bad defensive rebound team, despite having, you know, one of the best rebounders of all time on the team in Drummond. So I think it cleans up their defensive rebounding. I don't know that Griffin is that much worse than Harris is defensively, although he's going to have a massive offensive workload, so that's going to be a part of it. But Griffin is not as bad of a defender as he used to be, especially as the league has evolved more towards switching now. He can keep up with a lot of guys on the perimeter. I don't think that, like, moving his feet down the perimeter, he's much worse than Harris would have been. And so I think they could maybe get a little bit better defensively and maybe a little bit better offensively this year, because, as you mentioned, just getting rid of Avery Bradley, taking, you know, 25% usage at 50% true shooting will probably help you as well, to just get guys who are going to space out and shoot three-pointers. So maybe they take a little bit of a step forward this year. A lot of it depends on what you think of Bradley. So I'm coming around to it a little bit more as we think about it now, just for this year. But, I mean, your other problem, though, is Blake Griffin, known to suffer an injury or two, certainly with his declining athleticism, you expect him to fall off. And this, you know, this is going to be the best year for this group. I really don't see any way that they can much improve going forward, unless Reggie Jackson just comes back from this ankle injury and then just has a great summer and is unbelievable again. You know, I shouldn't say he was never unbelievable, but, you know, becomes a really quality starter again next year. And I see Griffin just continuing to decline, and I don't really see a way out of this for quite some time as well.
On the Blake Griffin help front, he's missed about a third of the Clippers games over the past 3 years combined. He played 67, then 35, then 61. So that's from 14-15 to now. And as you said, already missed time this season due to the knee issue. And with Blake, he has certainly gotten more skilled, and that has helped offset his athleticism decline. But his athleticism decline is also a part of this. I mean, we're not going to see even the Blake Griffin that we have today 2-3 years from now. That's just the way this works. Like, I always think back to something, I think Kevin Pelton wrote it, about how your physical peak is basically always declining from when a guy enters the league. It's just that they get more skilled and that offsets it. And then why a guy's prime is where it is because that's when the skill development is outpacing the physical decline. And with Blake Griffin, we're past that point probably now. And so, yeah, he's taking 2 threes a game so far this season. That's the first time, or he's making 2 threes a game. It's the first time he's attempted more than 2 in a game, averaged that for a season ever. So we'll see where that goes. But this is a long-term contract for a 28-year-old who is already kind of on the wrong side of a lot of the things that you're looking for. And that is a major concern for the Pistons because, as you said, it's hard for them to get better.
Let's turn to the Clippers now. First, from a financial standpoint, which I think is the bigger component of this, by being able to include Reed and Bryce Johnson, they are now at 14 roster slots, and they are $629,000 below the tax by my calculations. And that is probably enough room to eventually convert one of their two-way guys. They're going to wait absolutely as long as they can to either do that with Wallace or CJ Williams, who is out with an ankle sprain right now, but also fortunately not using up service time. But the more interesting part is, next summer. They still have Boban on the books. That's taking on bad money for next year. But of course, they get off of Griffin. Avery Bradley expires. He'll have a $13 million cap hold. You have to imagine, though, with his $8.8 million, he's not going to be a part of their long-term plans. Lou Williams, of course, expires as well. DeAndre Jordan, of course, expires as well. And so they could get to, under at least one scenario, if they moved on from Patrick Beverley, who's non-guaranteed for $5 million next year, if they wanted to waive and stretch Miles Teodosic, who has $2 million guaranteed, but also has a player option for next year, they could get to $24 million in space, also including, of course, that draft pick. And, you know, there's other things they could do as well to try to get off of Austin Rivers or get off of Wes Johnson, and they could open up even more space. You know, they might be able to get to Paul George land in terms of about $30 million or so if there was an indication that he wanted to come there. And then the year after that, they really have nearly nothing committed at all. It's basically Danilo Gallinari is their only large salary at $22 million, and you have to imagine Gallo will be the next guy they try to move. He's actually supposed to return as early as Tuesday now to open up a little bit more space. But they've got plenty of room now for over the next couple of years, and Woj tweeting with numerous clarifications that they're going to try to trade still DeAndre and Lou Williams, but also try to do reasonable extension talks with them at the same time and avoid bottoming out while still setting a new direction and getting more flexibility and blah, blah, blah. And it seemed like this was just such a good deal that they kind of had to do it. Who knows whether they even were like really like, yes, we really want to trade Blake Griffin, as opposed to Detroit saying, hey, we'd really like to get Blake Griffin. Who knows who started these talks, which apparently were ongoing for about a year or so. But seeing all that with this new financial reality or how it looks on the court, I mean, whatever you want to react to here from the Clippers standpoint, Danny.
It's amazing to me that they got off the contract. I think that's the most significant part of this. But where they pivot from, there are those two basic choices, really, where you can clear out because Avery Bradley and Tobias Harris are value. They're positive assets on their current contracts. You know, Tobias Harris, even if his three-point shooting isn't the ridiculousness it was early in the year, he still makes $14.8 million next year. It's a descending contract, which is great for them. Bradley, $8.8 million expiring this year. So if it were me and I were aggressive, I would try to move those guys again and just say, hey, we can get some assets for it. Avery Bradley's going to get paid on his next contract. We don't know what DeAndre Jordan's going to do, all that sort of thing. That's where I would be going. If they go the more measured route, those benefits get muted a little bit just because depending on how they use their space and all that kind of stuff. But again, like we've seen with the Clippers before, it's like there's a rationale for that. I just disagree with it. So I'm not as enthusiastic there. But the crazy part about this is I believe their roster makes more sense now after this trade than it did before. I mean, Avery, if they keep these guys, Avery Bradley can be a defensive linchpin for them. They can play him at the guard spot without Lou Williams, without Tate Dosic. Tobias Harris, you can put him at the three and the four, depending on what other guys you have around it. Like, there's a lot that you can do with it. It's far from perfect, obviously, but the roster was already far from perfect. So I could see them doing kind of keeping Doc happy or however you want to see it and keeping those guys together and actually being similar, if not better, to what they've been so far this year. And while I don't think that's the right thing long term, I actually expect that to be where this is going.
Yeah, Avery Bradley is a nice fit with Lou Williams and with Teodosic because neither of those guys can defend at all on the perimeter. The Gallo-Harris front court is certainly not the greatest defensively. I think we can acknowledge that, but hopefully they won't have to play those two guys together too much. They can bring in CJ Williams again once he's healthy. They've got Wes Johnson still who can defend at least a little bit better than those guys can. And then you've got a good shooting option in either Gallo or Harris to go around pick and rolls with DeAndre and Lou Williams or DeAndre and Teodosic. And I think while those players aren't individually as good as Griffin, it kind of fits better as long as you can get Lou Williams and, you know, who's their best player, of course, according to Chris Paul, who they're going to play through. Interesting that Blake's kind of last moment as a Clipper was that big win over the Rockets where he had like his jersey torn and like got into all those altercations with people, and now he's no longer there. It's pretty crazy to think about. But yeah, I think they do fit a little bit better. I wouldn't expect a significant downgrade from them this year. It's just going to be a very interesting question of playing time now in the backcourt between Williams, Austin Rivers when he comes back. Clearly Austin Rivers should be the one who's left out, but you know, his father's the coach, so you never know about that. Bradley, Teodosic, Tyrone Wallace, who's been really good for them, although Wallace can play some three as well and he can't shoot it all, so the fact that they have more shooting on the floor should help the fit with him. So yeah, I don't expect a massive massive drop off from where they've been. I think they'll continue to be around 500, but then of course there's the chance that DeAndre and Lou Williams could be traded as well, and if that happens, then they will fall out of playoffs.
Yeah, now they also really need to stay healthy now, because it's kind of it's a patchwork, but it's a patchwork that can hold if everybody's there together. And that's it's interesting for what they're going to do. And I still think of Gallo as a significant negative on his contract beyond the health stuff. I just think his game isn't aging particularly well, but it only ever takes one team. You know, that's really the story with the Blake Griffin thing, and he's a star as well. So Stan Van Gundy saw him differently than we do, and reasonable minds can differ, but I think that we've been borne out on that. So we'll see with Gallo. And then with DeAndre Jordan, he's more complicated because he's not under contract. He can do whatever he wants. And so the combination of this and the DeMarcus Cousins injury, like, he now becomes probably the preeminent center in free agency. Whether that means anything or not is a very different thing. And I'm not counting Jokic, because Jokic is a restricted free agent,
right,
is a totally different thing. And teams aren't going after him with the expectation of getting him. So I don't know how DeAndre feels about that, but that's something there. And then one other thing that I think we should discuss in this, because of our part in this whole thing in terms of the CBA, is remember that one of the points of negotiation for Blake Griffin, it was of course the years and the dollars, as it always is, but also the prospect of getting a no trade clause. And he did not get a no trade clause in his deal, but he did get the full maximum with a fifth year player option. So whether he is happy about this, however he feels about this move, this is why you secure a no trade clause, should not getting traded be important to you, because 7 months later, he's gone to a place that he would not have given a meeting to had he gone when he was a free agent.
Yeah. And this is also a great reason to get your money, though.
Right.
Because sometimes the reality of life in the NBA is that you can be traded. And as far as getting the no trade, you know, I'm not sure that he had the leverage to do that. I mean, apparently Steph Curry didn't even have the leverage to get a no trade, which I still think he probably could have fought a little bit harder for with the Warriors. But it certainly does not seem that the culture of the NBA really allows for no trades except in very specific circumstances, and that smart front offices just refuse to give them under any circumstances. It's kind of like where they don't want to set the precedent in the NFL. We're like, no, we just don't do that. You know, like they try that approach. It'd be interesting to see next time around which players are able to extract that sort of thing. But in a premium market like LA, and he clearly wanted to be in LA, I think that was a big part of the appeal. And certainly, you know, the Clippers are getting killed for the whole, hey, we told Blake Griffin he was going to be a Clipper for life, and their presentation at Staples Center was like a mock jersey retirement ceremony of like retiring the jersey of the greatest Clipper of all time. And you know, I think they gave it a go to some degree with Griffin. It's not like this team had been awesome this year. He got hurt again. Patrick Beverley got hurt. I think if they were on path for 50 wins, maybe this trade doesn't happen. But I think they also got bowled over to some degree by this Pistons offer to actually get this type of value for Griffin, given the nature of his contract.
And my last thought on this is, a few years ago, I wrote a piece that got a lot of crap on the Sporting News for arguing the case for trading Chris Paul. And then what was originally in my idea, but I didn't include because I didn't want Clippers fans to find my house and burn it down, was that they was the same idea with Blake Griffin, basically that it was time to move on. And the part of it that I got really wrong is that I thought basically once you got past that point, their value was going to drop. And with both of these trades, the Clippers did far better than I expected given the negotiating position they were in. They got quite a haul back for Chris Paul, who basically opted in to facilitate the trade. So he was on his way out. And then in this case, somebody overvalued Blake Griffin. So I have to give credit where credit is due, that I thought those assets were going to depreciate. And while I disagree with why they didn't, they ended up getting the results that worked out in the same way much later.
Yeah. And perhaps this is a lesson to us where now Griffin is a different animal than some of these other guys that are potentially going to get dumped in terms of bad salaries, because he is still productive. And he also, in theory, provides a boost in the box office. I mean, if you've seen the inside of Little Caesars Arena, that's not your eyes bleeding. It's just the seats there are red and you can see a lot of them. Perhaps the least exciting, least interesting new arena opening in NBA history right now in Detroit, where it seems like there are fewer people even than there were at the Palace of Auburn Hills. So maybe that was a component of this, feeling like they needed to acquire a star. And Griffin, even as of this very moment, is probably the best player they've had in a Pistons uniform since 2008. That means something in that market, I suppose, but and it means something to Stan Van Gundy to be able to acquire a player like that. but this still remains an expensive team that's at best a lower rung playoff team in the East. And that's now. It's just going to get worse there, I believe. Let's do a little more news here. Oh, actually, one other thing that I thought was kind of ironic. I forget who it was who pointed this out, but all of the people who convinced DeAndre Jordan to re-sign and, you know, in theory barricaded him into his Houston home, which obviously that was a joke, but that whole emoji thing on Twitter back in the summer of 2015. Oh yeah, they're all gone now from the Clippers, and DeAndre is the only one who's left. That's kind of funny.
It tells you how quickly this all can change. And the Clippers have, you know, they've made the playoffs since then. It wasn't like, oh, this was a total disaster and nothing went the way they wanted. It was just that things didn't work out in that way, and they were able to get assets for him.
So yeah, a couple other things that we need to talk about here before we get to Jim Boylan, the Chicago Bulls assistant coach. Joakim Noah left the Knicks for purportedly personal reasons, but it's not really personal reasons, maybe personality reasons more accurately. The story there from Sam Amick adding a little bit of color to the situation was that with Porzingis out and with Kyle O'Quinn out, Noah was told, hey, make sure you get ready to play, like, we're going to play. He'd only played, you know, less than 40 minutes on the season, and as a proud vet, he got ready to play and was not inserted until the fourth quarter and only played 4 minutes and then was taken out, and he was really upset by that. You know, the Knicks did not really manage expectations there, and then he continued to get into it with Hornacek at their next practice, and as a result was sent home, and no indication she'll be rejoining the team. They are looking for a solution to move him, but obviously he may be the most immovable contract in the NBA. He probably is at this point, and he would love to get a reset and go somewhere else, but he's also apparently not interested in a buyout. And so if you're not interested in a buyout, you're going to get the Luol Deng and you'll just not play and probably maybe not even be around the team unless he's willing to give back a significant amount of money, because as we've noted, once you buy a guy out or once you stretch him, that means that he's just stuck on your books. You can't trade him away should you need that flexibility later. So I don't expect him to go anywhere anytime soon.
I don't either, and I think I'm going to write on this at some point, but one of the key dates in this is actually, and I'm sure Noah doesn't want to hear this, is September 1st, because September 1st is when you can't stretch a guy for that year of the contract, but you can stretch them for the next year, and that right now is what I would be leaning towards if I were the Knicks, is keep on his full cap hit for the 2018-19 season, because they're not going to really have any flexibility anyway, so you're not losing anything. And then if you think that you're going to spend in the summer of 2019, then you can stretch that final year, and you can do that before the season so you clear that roster spot.
Yeah, if he were to be stretched this offseason, you're looking at about $7 million per season for the next 5 years, dead money on your cap. And again, as you said, doesn't really make a ton of sense to open up, you know, $10 million in room or something by stretching him for this year, unless there's some amazing plan that they have in the works. But where they are as a franchise, I think they're unlikely to make the playoffs this year. It really makes sense to just keep swallowing that extremely disgusting medicine. And, you know, maybe in the summer of 2019, you stretch him, especially if Kristaps Porzingis does not sign an extension. And then maybe you can finagle some cap space using Porzingis' cap hold as a restricted free agent in the summer of 2019. That's what I would be pushing for if I were the Knicks.
A couple of just injury and health related pieces before we let this go. Trevor Ariza has what has been reported as a left hamstring strain. He left Sunday's game and he will not play in the Rockets' next game. I can't remember whether that's Monday or Tuesday. Joel Embiid was originally, it was very exciting, he was going to play in his first back-to-back of his NBA career, but then after they lost to the Thunder, the Sixers changed course and he is not going to play Monday night against the Bucks.
Yeah, it was due to heavy loading in that OKC game, apparently, since he played the whole game. And I think that will do it for us here. We'll be right back with Bulls assistant Jim Boylan. This is a fun conversation. Get into a lot of the technical aspects of defense, coaching defense, and his move from San Antonio to Chicago, among other topics. So stay tuned for that right after this from Sherry's Berries. They and Pro Flowers have teamed up to help you impress your Valentine this year with their perfectly paired collection. You know why they're advertising here. Valentine's Day is just around the corner. So this is a one-of-a-kind gift with those fantastic Sherry's Berries dipped strawberries and the flowers arriving together in a beautiful, specially designed box that will keep your berries cold and your flowers fresh. Guaranteed, I've gotten plenty of Pro Flowers flowers before. Always delight my significant other or her mom as well. The way they send it, it's guaranteed to keep the flowers fresh. There's all these instructions on how to take care of them as well, and they last for well over a week in my experience if you follow those instructions. games, and those dipped strawberries are absolutely delicious. Right now, my listeners can save 20% on any one of their perfectly paired combinations or any other gift over $29 as well. So you can go there and check it out with, hey, guess what the promo code is? Capspace. Easy to remember. We've been talking about Capspace all the time on the program. And, you know, that's the promo code for every single one of our sponsors as well. So the way to do that, go to berries.com, berries.com today. Enter that Capspace code at checkout. That'll get you 20% off that perfectly paired gift over $29 or any other gift over $29 at berries.com, promo code Capspace. Enter that Capspace code. Let them know that you came from us. Now I want to welcome in Jim Boylan, associate head coach of the Bulls under Fred Hoiberg, also worked in San Antonio under Greg Popovich. He was with Rudy Tomjanovich in Houston as well as a head coach at the University of Utah. Jim, great to have you on.
Thanks, Nate. Excited to be with you.
Yeah, so one thing I wanted to talk about first, really, before we get into some more of the specifics, is just to talk a little bit about, you know, what you guys' core philosophies are at the Bulls, and just the coaching profession in general. You know, if you wanted to look at what your core philosophies are, just from an X's and O's standpoint, both offensive and defensively with the Bulls, what are some of the things that you guys really have been seeking to emphasize under Fred Hoiberg?
Well, I feel like offensively, you know, we want to play with pace. I think that's Coach Hoiberg's number one goal, is for us to play with pace, and not to be mistaken for quick shots, but quality shots, try to get good looks early in the clock, try to push the ball, try to put pressure on the defense, try to run things that get us shots before the length and, you know, the defensive presence sets up in the half court. So that, I think that's A1, is to try to get our guys to run and play faster. Defensively, you know, we kind of believe in the math here. So, you know, take away corner threes, contest the rim, limit rim opportunities, and make people play between the three-point line and kind of restricted area. And that's everywhere I've been. Defensively in Indiana, we had a great defensive team. That was our philosophy. San Antonio, a terrific defensive team. And, you know, make people play in that middle ground, make people play off the bounce. So those are kind of our two core basketball philosophies here. You know, play with pace, and then at defensive end, keep people in front of us, make them play over us, contest the corner threes, and protect the rim.
So one of the things that you talked about that I wanted to elaborate on a little bit more, you talked about playing with pace on the offensive end. And one of the things that's really, you know, if you even compare today's game maybe to 5 years ago, and certainly 10 years ago, you'll see guys, you can come down if you're off the dribble and you're open and shoot a three-pointer really early in the clock. When was it really, and pretty much any NBA team can do that now, you know, but it seemed like 10 years ago, even if you were open for a three early on, that probably would have been considered a bad shot because you're that early in the clock. When did that really begin to change for you? And I mean, or just in your observations, and what was it you think that made NBA coaches say, you know what, maybe this is a good shot to take an open three, even if it is early in the clock?
Well, a couple things. You know, I think the defense league has advanced, you know, from the schemes to the athleticism to people switching more. So an open shot's an open shot. If it's early in the clock and you can get a good quality look, I think you have to take it. I also feel like, you know, people are playing three and four shooters on the floor at the same time. So sometimes that open look comes earlier. So again, I think you have to take it. You know, in the old days, you didn't have, you know, the four man didn't shoot it as well. Now we have five shooting it, the five man shooting it. And, you know, so we felt like, I know, you know, Coach Pop was big on open looks. You know, can we get uncontested shots regardless of where they're at in the clock? And you're going to make more of those than you are contested shots. And I think that's what's happened. People just realize, whether it's early or late, if you can get an open, clean look, you know, let's take it. And it's been fun. I think it's been great for the league, and the scores are up, and, you know, guys seem to really be enjoying the way the game's played now.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. That's a good point, is that maybe more of those shots are being taken just because there's more people who can take those shots now, right? I mean, you know, if you had Reggie Miller, he probably could have taken that shot at any time, you know, if it was early in the clock. But, you know, if you had, you know, a traditional four, traditional five, that's not really available. Like, that trail three wasn't really available as often. So, yeah, that's an interesting point, that it's not even so much that you want them to take the shot. It's just there's more guys that actually is a good shot for, and so the opportunity is there more often.
I agree. And the other thing is that the NBA game now uses more of the floor. You know, the sprint to deep right corner. The spacing is better. All those things have contributed to those the higher three-point attempts, higher three-point makes, and the whole floor is being used now. And I think it's helped our game. It's made it more fun to watch. It's made it more fun to play. And also, you know, all those long rebounds, too, lead to runouts. All those long rebounds lead to sometimes offensive rebounds and more threes. And it just kind of all fits together. And it's exciting. You watch a game now compared to 10 years ago, it looks like a totally different game, Nate.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, I was lucky enough to be living in Arizona, actually, 10 years ago. So I might have been the one guy who watching the Suns who it doesn't look that different. But even then, like, I mean, the Suns were taking, you know, they're making like 9 threes a game back then, and that was considered amazing. And now that's like, you know, the worst team in the league is making 9 threes.
Yeah, the numbers have just, they've gone up so quickly and they keep rising. Again, I think the skill level of our guys, the development of guys that can shoot the ball at every position, and then the dynamic guard play, you know, where guys get downhill, make the defense shift, spray it out, and then, you know, play the 2-on-1 game on the backside is just, it's fun basketball and it's simple and you can do it a lot of different ways. And I think you have to give that Phoenix team credit for kind of starting that, and then Houston building on it. And then you start doing the math and you get the guys upstairs figuring out the math, and that sells it too, right? That makes sense too. So
hey, don't give away Steve Weinman's secrets now.
Steve Weinman's a sharp guy. He's really helped us. He's fun to go up and talk to and kind of banter back and forth, and he's fun to argue with about certain stuff. He believes in the math, and he does a great job of supporting us.
So just from as a coaching staff, when you're really just, you know, this is the type of thing coaches just love practice, right? And obviously you don't get as much of a chance to do that in the NBA as you might in college, but just what are some of your favorite drills to run for some young coaches who might be listening to this, or just people who want to know what's going on in NBA practice? Just for you guys as a coaching staff, like, what do you think are just some of the best basic drills that you can run to try and keep your guys sharp?
Well, one thing that we do here that I think is maybe different than other places, but everybody has their version of the shell drill. So
yeah,
your stance, position, you're communicating your position to support your teammate. And some people call it the shrink, gap defense, you know, whatever your name of it is, pack line, you know, where you have pressure on the ball, but you're in your gaps on either side. Tom Izzo calls it six-eye help. You're in six-eye help. You know, we call it five-man shell. And a lot of teams do four-man shell. We believe in the five-man shell with either the center high or the center low. And that's where the NBA is at now. The center sometimes is high and sometimes the center is low, but you have to be able to defend in either situation. Also, the freedom for the center to trap the box, the freedom for the center to challenge plays at the rim, but have his back covered. It's kind of the help the helper philosophy.
Yeah.
So we do that out of five-man shell. We also do it out of diamond shell. And those are two things that I think have really helped us, which gives Robin Lopez the freedom to protect the rim, but knowing that the backside is covered. And then, you know, we work on the X-ing out the backside, covering the corner. And within that five-man shell, you know, we build our seek level concepts. We build our trap-the-box concepts, and we build our shift-to-close concepts. So I think that's one of the better things we do here and we've done with our young team. And, you know, trying to get guys that maybe are more offensive players than defensive players to at least be in the right position, start the possession in the right place, and hopefully that helps them finish it in the right place depending on what happens. So, you know, we talk a lot about one-way help, not being two ways, you know, where they get to pitch out threes or they get to nail pitch threes.
Well, yeah. So explain to that. What does that mean? What one-way help? That's not
so,
a term,
you know,
that I've heard before.
Let's say the ball's in the slot, you know, off the elbow in the slot, and that guy drives the nail. Well, we want to protect the nail and be one way. So on that drive, we're in, inside foot to the midpoint, ready to spray out to that slot, to his slot. So we don't want to be out guarding the slot and then run in to help and be two ways, where you run in to help, and as you're running in, they're pitching that ball back out, and they might get the slot three or they might swing to corner because your stunt to stunner is not as good and your one-way shift wasn't as good. So those are things you, in our philosophy, that you have to work on daily.
Yeah.
And again, be one way. So you're shifted already. As that drive happens, now you close. And it's hard for guys to grab that concept. It's hard for guys, especially young players, to understand how far they can come And if they react on the flight of the ball, and as soon as that ball leaves the passer's hands, they can recover. Because guys at this level, athletic, can cover ground. They just don't always realize it yet. And maybe they haven't taught the right technique. So we spend a lot of time on that. And again, you know, trying to keep people in front of us, not give up open threes, and then any penetration, you know, trying to rally the penetration and then work our way out of the next pass. And, you know, I love it. I think that's the fun part of practice. And then you kind of put it in. We put it in 1-on-1, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 4-on-4. And then about December 15th, we go to the 5-on-5. So it's not something we do from day one.
Interesting.
Everything's a progression, and we kind of graduate to it. And feel like our guys have kind of mastered the 4-on-4. And then you put the fifth guy in it, and then you really talk your shift and close concepts. So
yeah.
It's exciting when the guys get it, Nate. You know, it's fun.
Yeah, and so I guess if I can try to translate what you're saying here, it's basically before someone starts this drive, you want to be in help position so that then, you know, you're kind of deterring the drive by already being there, and then you're mentally ready that as soon as that pass out goes, you're ready to close back out on your man. And because, like, you know, someone like Harden, I think, is unbelievable at this, where if you're not there yet, as soon as you take even one step towards him, he throws the pass right past you, right? So it's like,
LeBron's made it too. We call it the zip pass. You know, they see you leaning, or you're coming in when you should be going out, and they're going to hit you with that zip pass, and then, you know, they create those open looks. Harden's also great at splitting the nail, where he pulls the ball through and stretches through and, you know, gets the fouls, and he has such a big glide and stride step that he can stride through that nail and make plays. He's so strong that way.
Yeah, so you're talking about like when he'll kind of, I've heard coaches talk about it as the Harden, where he'll kind of extend the ball out in front of him, bring his arms right through. I actually just hit my microphone demonstrating it in front of me. But yeah, he'll bring his arms through as that guy, if his body is not there, he'll just, you know, if he sticks an arm out to try to go for the steal, Harden will just bring his arms right through, and then it's a foul, and you know, he can probably get an and one off of that, at least under the old rules.
Yeah, so, you know, he gets the ball past the defender's body by stretching, and official sees that. He sees that he's kind of gaining an advantage, and he gets more calls that way.
Yeah.
If the ball was tucked or not past the defender's body, it wouldn't look the same. So there's a visual part to it, too, for the officials, you know, along with the technique. And that's a special skill by him. And some guys are starting to pick it up, too. Other guys are starting to get it and understand it. But what we talk about is recovering to your help position. So let's say maybe you chase a guy over a flare. Let's say you exchange on the second side. Well, we want to recover to a help position, not recover to where we're hugging our man.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you have to determine what's the first side, second side. Some people call it strong side, weak side. You know, there's middle third, outer third, you know, so all those kind of concepts of where you're at, what position you're in, what space you're in, and what the action is, you know, you can drill that in that shell drill and kind of hopefully, you know, master those concepts. And we spend a lot of time on that, Nate.
So as a coaching staff, and you've hit on it a little bit here, but like, what is something that your team, you know, if you practice it and you see the team do it, where you and Fred kind of look at each other on the bench and like, yeah, that's what we wanted there. Like, what is the stuff that just really like gets you excited as a coach to see your team execute in a game?
Well, I think defensively, you know, we like teams that have activity and communicate and can adjust. And, you know, I was privileged to be with the Spurs and during that championship run in 14. And, you know, we could change pick and roll coverages in the quarter two or three times. And our guys could adjust, and they could adjust to the activity or the action that's going on in the game with activity and awareness. And when you see teams that can flow into their defense and maybe one possession switch it, they communicate it. Maybe a guy comes off clean and they switch a pin down where they talk it out and get it covered, then they wipe the post. So to me, it's those teams that can anticipate what's going on. If they make a mistake, they can cover for each other with effort, you know, toughness, communication. You know, I like watching Golden State. I think they do a great job of knowing when to switch and when not to. And then when there's a situation maybe they're not in control of, they can work their way out of it. And I felt like that team in 14 with the Spurs was like that too. You know, we could work our way out of situations and help each other, support each other, communicate, and that gets us excited. And we're trying to incorporate that with our team. You know, it's communicate. You're a family. Help each other. Protect each other. And, you know, schemes are one thing, but things happen in the game where you just have to react. And
yeah,
we're trying to instill that into our guys.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people don't understand about personnel is that, like, it can't all be coaching. It's got to be some pattern recognition from the players to really be like, all right, I've been in this situation before. We can do it on the fly. We have an understanding of, all right, you know, maybe we're both not on our man, but I'm bigger than you and you've got a bigger guy. Let's just switch behind the play. You know, that kind of stuff, it makes such a difference in today's
getting NBA. Getting under non-shooters, keeping it simple. You know, switching equals, switch partners, we call it. You know, just those basic, simple things. And then, you know, the league sometimes, the side pick and roll scheme right now, you know, people are exploiting the blue coverage or the ice coverage,
right.
You know, the forcing the pick and roll down. People are exploiting that now with the short pick and roll, the pocket pass extra. So, you know, I think there's a place sometimes for just keeping your man in front, maybe even pushing them to the middle of the floor on a pick and roll. You know, it doesn't always have to be a force down. It doesn't always have to be a coverage where you're creating a driving lane to the hoop because, you know, defenses can be figured out, and offenses have evolved into where, you know, they can wear that situation out. When that blue defense was put in 15 years ago or whenever it was, I think I was in Houston when that started, but, you know, there wasn't the extra shooter on the floor, Nate.
Yeah.
So now there's an extra shooter out there, and so the blue defense, the force down, doesn't always apply. And I think,
because with a pick and pop big on a side pick and roll, the pocket extra,
you know, all those subtleties of the pick and roll offensive game.
What's a pocket extra, by the way, real quickly?
That's when I have, you know, how the big rolls, kind of short rolls.
Yeah.
And they throw it, a bounce pass to him in the pocket right there.
Right.
So and then he takes it and finds somebody else. Maybe it's corner, maybe it's slot. So the pocket extra, maybe it's to the room. He passes it to the guy underneath the basket, you know, where they put so much pressure because the ball's inside your defense.
Yeah.
And you can spray it out or you can take it to the rim. And because you've brought two to the ball in your force down coverage, now they're playing numbers on the backside, and that starts with that pocket pass. And, you know, Boston kind of started that with the Doc Rivers team with Garnett, where they would get in the pocket and they'd wear people out with that. And people have adapted that, and it's really put pressure on your team defense.
Well, so I wanted to talk a little bit more about your personal history. And it's really interesting to me just the idea of how it is that coaches, you know, get the jobs that they have, especially for assistants, how do you move from job to job? So can you just kind of tell the story of how it came about that summer that you made the move to Chicago and what that interview process was like? I mean, and I'm sure people would love to know just like how even you prepare for like a coaching interview.
Well, I think one thing that's really important, I think, for young coaches and something I really believe in is you're never really looking for the next job. To me, if you're trying to do the job you have the best you can.
Yeah.
And I think that's
because if where you were in the last place didn't say you did a good job, you're not getting another job anyway. So,
yeah, I just think that's like A1, you know. Do the job you have the best you can. Help your head coach, you know, with your work ethic and your honesty, and you know, don't be afraid to have the tough conversation or you know, suggest what you believe in, you know, from the work you've done and your experiences. So, to me, that's the best part of it, you know. And then going from the Spurs to Chicago was a very difficult decision in a lot of ways, The Spurs have a great organization. They were unbelievable to me. I learned a ton. I grew there as a person, as a coach. My family loved it there. So it was more about the opportunity in Chicago to help Fred and to help the franchise. I was really impressed with the ownership here and Gar and John. And, you know, they obviously felt that I could help. They felt that there was a role for me here, and I was excited about that role, and it worked out. And it was not easy to leave the Spurs, but my wife and I felt, you know, for our family that it was a good move. And, you know, we're thankful we're here. And, you know, we still have those relationships with the Spurs. But we still have our house, actually, in San Antonio. So it's a dear, dear place to us.
Yeah. And when you know, did you have a relationship with Fred before you moved to Chicago?
Not really. I didn't really know Fred. I had met him. He had come to, when I was at Utah, we played LSU in a preseason game. and it was a big game, and there was a lot of scouts there, and he was scouting for, or he was working for Minnesota in the front office. And after the game, he was at a dinner at, I think it was P.F. Chang's. A bunch of scouts went down there, and a couple guys asked me if I wanted to show up down there and have something to eat with him. So I went down there, and I sat next to Fred.
That's kind of how, if it was scouts, it was either P.F. Chang's or Cheesecake Factory, right?
Yeah. And, so, you know, I sat next to Fred, and we had a real good conversation, and we had a big win that night and played well. And I don't know, he just seemed like a really genuine, good guy. You could tell he just passionate about the game, and we had a good talk, and that was kind of it. And then his opportunity came up here, and they contacted RC, and then I was actually in Treviso at the Treviso camp, at the Euro camp, and RC called my, called my cell phone. I can't remember what time of day it was, but it was like middle of the night, I think. And that Chicago had an interest, and did I want to talk to him? And, you know, so we went through that process. So that's kind of how it all started. And I flew in from Treviso into Chicago and met with them, and you know how Nate, things happen quickly. So the Pop was very supportive and kind of helped walk me through it and gave his suggestions and what he thought would be good and not good. And RC was very supportive too. So once you're a Spur, you're just always kind of part of that family, and they're just terrific people. You know, what you hear and what you see is exactly who they are. So they made it real easy for me, and they were very supportive. And Fred, you know, Fred's one of those guys that, you know, the first time you sit with him, it's like you feel like you're sitting with family, you know. So that made it easy too.
So when you find out in Treviso you're going to be doing this interview, you've only got, I'm guessing, a couple of days. What are you doing during that time? Are you trying to say, okay, you know, if he asked me about this, here's what I think we should do with our existing personnel, or like, you know, are there suggestions, or is the interview kind of more just a, because as a lawyer, for example, we would get asked very few actually like technical questions in an interview. For whatever reason, it was all about just what's the personality fit going to be like. So is it kind of more of that type of interview, or are they really like, hey, you know, technically, what do you think, you know, or some ideas that we might want to implement?
There were some technical questions. I also came prepared with, I think, a pretty good working knowledge of the team. So I did some studying of the team. I had, you know, two or three days where I could, you know, study their stats, study their numbers, study their roster. You know, it's just basketball. You know what I mean? And I don't mean to sound like flippant, but it's you know, we're all in the league. I think we understand the league. And you know, there's certain things you need to do in our league to win. You know, you got to guard, you got to rebound, you got to run back, and it kind of all starts with the basics. And so we really talked about the basics in the interview and my background a little bit. And they did ask me a few questions about the team, what I thought. I think also when they bring you in like that and you're the first guy in, I think they kind of know they want you, Nate, and they just want to kind of talk to you a little bit, see where you're at, and then the negotiation started. So, I was really thankful for the opportunity, and, you know, wasn't sure what I was going to do right away, and just we kind of worked our way through it. So, I think the other thing, too, is you can over-prepare. You can over-analyze. I think you have to trust your instincts. You have to trust your gut. You have to rely on what you've done and your body of work and the knowledge of the team and the league, and I felt like I did have a lot of experience there.
Yeah, I think it's interesting what you said about, you know, they had a pretty good idea that they wanted you. I mean, that's, you know, maybe for us out here in the public, it's tough to tell, okay, you know, what is Jim Boylan doing exactly for the Bulls, and, you know, what credit do we give to him for their success? But within the league, I think it seems like people really have a good idea of, like, who is doing a good job, and you can get a good reputation because it is such a small fraternity.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is a small group of guys, and it's I think we're all trying to just improve and coach our guys, have our guys grow, but, you know, hold them accountable. Development's big here. I learned a lot about development in Indiana and in San Antonio before I got here, and I think that's one thing that Fred has done a great job of, and developing kind of our young core and our guys, and having them play with confidence and feel good about what they're doing and where they're going, and just having a feel for they're a good player and they can help us win, and then putting them in a situation to do that. And that's been fun, you know, with this group of guys, and it's been fun to see our guys grow. And Fred's done a great job with that. And, you know, you have to give Gar and John credit too. I think the culture that's been set this year and the way our guys are playing and supporting each other and working together, it's been a really fun year. really fun year.
So you mentioned player development. Can you just take for those who are not in an NBA arena before games and obviously are not in practice, just how do you kind of break up the individual work, whether it's workouts for individual skill development, whether it's film? Are there a certain coach who is like assigned to each player, or do you split that up? Like how do you do that with the Bulls?
Well, we have we have coaches who are assigned to individual players for their on-court work, their individual on-court work, which is before the game, but also, before and after practice. And then we also have assignments for film, who we watch film with, who we support with film. Guys learn a couple different ways, right? Some guys are tonal and visual, kinesthetic, whatever it is. So we try to hit them on all those levels and, just try to have them absorb as much as they can. I'll watch film with Dunn and Markkanen and Levine are kind of my guys, and Zach's just got back. So, and then Coach Myers will watch film with Bobby Portis and Chris Felicio and Robin Lopez, and but we're not as rigid maybe as other teams where we all help each other. We all can show anybody film, and sometimes we mix it up to give a fresh voice. Sometimes we mix it up to give a little different perspective. And then Fred watches a lot of film with guys too, and from the head coach's chair, I think it's important too that he watches with him and puts time in, and Fred does a good job of that. He enjoys that. And, I thought Pop was great at, picking a guy and at a certain time, maybe during the year or whatever, and just sitting with him and watching film and maybe help him through a tough spot or maybe help him grow in a different way. And so, the old adage, it kind of takes a village, Nate. I think it's that way on a staff too. Different guys can reach different people. Sean Respert's our player development coach, and he helps everybody and works out everybody, but he also has guys that he spends more time with and kind of younger guys, or maybe the guys not playing as much. He keeps them ready. So he has a voice, and a former player and a guy that's been hurt, a guy that has been in the league and understands it. So he's been a big addition to our staff this year and a big help. And it's been fun for me to see him here because, I coached him in college at Michigan State. So kind of cool to have him on our staff too.
Oh yeah. Wow. I forgot about that. You'd have been there at that time.
Great college player, man.
Yeah. So let's. You say you work with Lowry a lot before the games, for just to use him as an example. He's obviously a fantastic shooter. Fastest to 100 threes of anyone in NBA history in his rookie year, but has a unique skill set. But when you go out there with him, whether it's before a game or before and after practice, how do you decide what you're going to work on? Do you figure that out ahead of time, or you kind of see how he's feeling that day? What is just the plan of what we're going to do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, we script all that. Yeah. And those workouts are set up to incorporate some of what we do in our system, and also maybe what a guy needs to work on, and also to get him ready and loose to play the game. So it's kind of on a couple different levels. Obviously, sometimes you have 10 minutes, sometimes you have 15 minutes. At the most, I think it's 15. We sometimes cut ours back to 10, depending on fatigue levels and number of games played and all those kind of things. So those things are discussed during the day. But, Lowry's one of those guys that's kind of fun to work out because, he can play in the post, he can play facing, he can drive the ball, you're kind of touching on all those areas and just trying to get him ready to play the game and obviously refine his skills. But it's more about the repetition and just making him feel comfortable. And he's so smart that it's he's a pretty easy guy to deal with and work with. He just picks up things so quickly, understands at a young age, kind of what he needs to do. So he's a pretty low maintenance dude.
Yeah, everything you hear about him is that he's an awesome guy to work with. Going back to college and with the Finnish team. All right, so last question here, because I know you got to get going. You guys started the year really rough patch, 3-20. I think I saw kind of the nadir for you guys. I was out in Golden State when you had that really rough loss to the Warriors. But since then, you've been able to turn around, and some of that, of course, is getting healthy. But other than that, what have you guys been able to emphasize as a coaching staff that the team has implemented that accounts for some of that improvement?
Well, first of all, Fred has done a great job of holding the group together during that time. We never felt like we were in a losing streak. We never felt like we were 3-20, which, as you know, that's usually not the case, right?
Yeah.
But we just never felt that way. We worked hard in practice. Guys were listening. listening. Film sessions were good. People were locked in and passionate about what we're doing. So I was really thankful for that as we were going through that. And then we started to play better. We got healthy and sharing the ball, playing for each other, understanding our end of game package. You know, I know you've seen some of our games where we've won some close games at the end and, you know, putting the ball in the right position with the right guys and making plays at the end and seeing that growth and having games maybe when during that losing streak where we failed to do that, but
yeah,
maybe made the right plays, ball didn't go in. Maybe we didn't make the right play and we learned from it. And, you know, we were up 16 at Indiana, I think, with 5 minutes to go and lost. And the next night we played at Charlotte and won. That's kind of when that kind of thing changed. I also feel like we got a little ticked off, you know, and we got a little upset. Hey, we can't keep doing this. We can't. And we kind of gritted our teeth and we kind of refined our edge and we started playing better. So it's a combination of things. But I think Fred does a great job of keeping our guys loose and positive, but also holding them accountable and having them grow. And, you know, nothing grows without some shade, some sun, some rain. So we've had a little of all that and our guys seem to be developing and getting better and it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, is there anything that you just feel like from a specific standpoint that just you've been able to do better as the years gone on the floor other than the late game stuff?
Our player movement, you know, I think being able to move the ball and moving bodies and moving the ball. I think at one time we were one of the top teams in the league at player movement and just having the ball move around the horn, having guys share it, move it. I think that's, if you can get that unselfishness to a young group to trust each other and share it, I think if we could keep instilling that culture, you know, it's going to be a hell of a year for us, Nate.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Jim. We really appreciate you coming on and appreciate also, we'll see, hopefully the audience can translate some of the coaching concepts you gave earlier. You're over my head even a little bit there at times, but that's what we want on the show. And hopefully we're able to educate people a little bit more about some of the NBA schemes. And we really appreciate you coming on. This was great.
Okay, Nate. Thank you for the time. Take care.